And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with University of Illinois professor, media scholar, and author Robert McChesney. His latest work is Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And Professor Robert McChesney joins us now from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So you say the internet was supposed to be the great equalizer, but large corporate monopolies working together with the government have stolen the promise of the internet to suit their own interests. Why don't we begin right there?
Well, that's a pretty good summary. I think there's a lot more to the book, obviously, than that. But, you know, the promise of the internet, and I think a lot of people still hold the promise, it's still widely held, was that it was the great equalizer. It was going to give people all sorts of power they never had before, to vanquish tyrannical governments, monopolistic dinosaur firms that could sort of ride roughshod over people with their market power. It would sort of level the class differences, the benefits of income, in education and knowledge. And it would be a challenge to political parties to get with the program and to respond more to people and to come up with politics that were more popularly embraced. All these things were the great promise of the internet in the early 90s. And again, they still hold through to this day, but especially in the early 90s, because then it was predicated on the idea that the internet was going to be a non-commercial space, that it was going to be, you know, there was advertising and public relations and spin and manipulation out there everywhere else. And the internet was going to be a place where people came together as equals. They came together and found material they shared as fellow citizens. There wasn't selling and manipulation going on. And that was the, I mean, and I think we've lost our memory of that to some extent. That was the internet 20 years ago. That was the internet of the 80s into the 90s. And deep into the 1990s, commercial interests were hard-pressed to figure out how they could properly commercialize it and make money off it.
Actually, isn't that awfully idealistic to have that view, even in the 90s, that if somebody can make a buck, they're going to find a way to do it? Come hell or high water.
I mean, I guess that's one way to look at things. But at the same time, the internet was created by the government. It was created by massive government investments that set up rules and policies. In the 1970s, the government actually offered the internet to AT&T. It said, you can take this thing over. And AT&T studied it. So, you know, we don't see how we can make money off of this thing. You guys keep it. And, you know, the process by which it went from being a non-commercial to a commercial process wasn't simply sort of like a bunch of people stood around and said, well, that's human nature. You know, that's the way it's got to be. We heard it on a radio show. But rather, it was, you know, a complex process which had opposition at various points, but ultimately did triumph. But at every point, there were lots of Americans who were troubled by the idea that we would have rampant commercialism, as I think there are probably more today than there were at any time in the last 15 years.
You go on to say that policies are being made without our informed consent that benefit commercial interests and just these monopolies. What policies are you referring to?
Well, lots of them, but let's start with perhaps the most basic one. Most Americans, in fact, all Americans, they have cell phones or they access the internet through a wireline broadband connection with a cable wire in all likelihood, though possibly there's some people still getting on telephone lines. You get your internet access through what is really what I describe as a cartel. Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, and the few other players have more or less divided up the market. There's very, very little competition in the economic sense of the term. As a result of this, Americans pay far more for the broadband internet, wire internet. They pay far more for cell phone service than people do in most other comparable countries, and we have a much worse service. Now, the reason for this is corrupt politics. The reason for this is that these companies dominate in Washington, D.C. Verizon and AT&T were never free market companies that won some heroic battle of garage entrepreneurs outsmarting each other. They were always government monopoly created enterprises where they got monopoly licenses from the government for telephone service and Comcast for cable service. And their genuine expertise was in dealing with politicians and regulators, getting their way with them, getting these monopoly licenses. And they are expert at that to this day. The line in Washington is that The difference between having a Republican administration and a Democratic administration is whether AT&T overtly or covertly writes the laws and the rules regarding telecommunication and the internet. And so that's one direct place where Americans pay right out of their pocket, but we pay much more for these services, get lousier service, and it's because these interests dominate Washington, D.C.
So you blame both parties for these failures?
Well, yeah, and blame, you know, the book isn't
or
about
you
blame
put responsibility.
I'm a Lutheran minister.
Right, right.
You know, I'm trying to make an honest assessment, and clearly I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of large commercial interest. And the Democratic Party is to a lesser extent. But the difference between the two parties is that the voting base of the Democratic Party tends to be unsympathetic to that agenda. So that's always a certain amount of tension, which means there's a lot more breathing room on the Democratic side. But both parties are complicit in this. And I think that the reason for that is that, among other things, these companies are rich and powerful. And in the way politics plays itself out in Washington, D.C. today, more so than 30 or 40 years ago, is that money rules. The money dominates. And it's almost impossible to look at any policy issue surrounding the internet that's been developed in the last 20 years and not notice a few striking things. First of all, they're almost always made with very little public involvement whatsoever. Secondly, there's very little press coverage except in the business press, where it's presented as an issue of importance to investors and companies. And third, therefore, the public has almost no say in the outcome, but it lives with the consequences of the outcome.
Robert McChesney, give us your view of the Snowden affair.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I wrote this book in 2012, and I've been researching it for years. I think I sent it off to the publisher the last second in November, December of last year. And I have a section in there in one of the chapters that concludes in Chapter 5 called The Military Digital Complex, because just using the press reports and government reports I had access to last fall and the interviews I saw with security experts that I based the chapter on, it was obvious pretty much to me, and I think the evidence said it pretty clearly, that what the Snowden affair has, you know, provided substance to, which is that the largest computer companies in America are working very closely and very amiably with the NSA and the national security agencies to monitor Americans across the board. And not just Americans, but I was in the book writing about Americans, that this was known last year. I mean, it really wasn't a surprise. Anyone who read my book would say, yeah, well, obviously this is what all these experts are saying last fall. There was sort of this wasn't really a shocker. What Snowden did, and the Snowden affair did, is it just had a mountain of evidence that was undeniable, that sort of you couldn't just say that's hearsay or that's just some expert's opinion. And I think what the Snowden affair tells us, first and foremost, it's a real comment on the decline of journalism in the United States in the last generation, just the lack of resources and the lack of integrity to journalism, that this story requires a Snowden release, Snowden dump of documents, and that it requires a British newspaper to publicize it, when it was just sitting there like the lowest hanging fruit imaginable for any American journalist or newsroom to go after and study. Now, as I say that, there were some journalists who've done great work. Dana Priest of the Washington Post did a wonderful series that became a book 3 years ago on the national security complex that sort of suggested a lot of what we have learned from the Snowden affair. But as a rule, you know, for all the time, you know, it was ironic during the Snowden affair that, you know, when Snowden was landing in Moscow, there were, you know, dozens of journalists and cameras and the eyes of the world on Snowden. You know, and I think if we had a healthier journalism, there would have been as many reporters actually sort of following up on what those revelations really meant, where the guilty parties were, what laws were broken, and trying to have some semblance of the rule of law in this country.
Let's look more at journalism right now. You say we can't have a free society if journalists can't make a living being journalists. How much do you feel the internet is responsible for aggravating an already critical situation?
You know, it's impossible to say precisely how much the internet is responsible, but it's clearly accelerated the process, the decline of journalism, and it's made it permanent. And what I mean by that is that journalism, the resources going to journalism, in American news media for the last 30 years have been declining on a per capita basis. Not especially sharply initially, but they were declining. And it was very striking in the 1990s, which were years of extraordinarily profitable years for American news media. Yet on balance, on per capita terms, they were reducing the number of reporters and their foreign bureaus while they were making all this money. And then finally, when the internet came along, it sort of pushed it over a cliff. And we've seen as a free fall disintegration, to mix my metaphors, of journalism in the last 10 years. The number of working journalists today and the resources going to journalism today compared to two decades ago on a per capita basis is probably 30-40% of what existed then. Newsrooms today look like mausoleums. They look like cemeteries. 20 years ago, they were vibrant and jumping with people. It is a real crisis. And why the internet has accelerated it, and I talk about this in the book, and why it's made it permanent, is that advertising, which had provided 50 to 100% of the revenues for journalism for the last century, depending on the medium, advertising is going through a revolutionary transformation online. And this, interestingly enough, relates to the Snowden question before, because the way they've commercialized the internet, companies have found a way to make the most money is not necessarily by selling stuff directly online, but providing services for free and then using that as an opportunity to basically monitor people online to learn everything they do everywhere they go. So they know everything about them. So they can then tailor advertising messages and other messages directly to individuals, knowing what would be most likely to produce the desired results. And so we have now what's called smart advertising, and it's $30 billion roughly this year, and it will be more. It's growing rapidly. And this means that when a company advertises online, it doesn't buy a website. It doesn't buy a TV station's website or ESPN or a newspaper or any content producer, but rather it goes through a major network like Microsoft has or Yahoo or Google, and it says, I want to buy women 29 to 34 who are in the market for automobiles. And it will find 10 million of those women instantly, by the way. It does it in real time almost, wherever they go, whatever websites they go to, because these networks know exactly where to find all these women. And the amount of money that then goes to a news medium, let's say a woman sees the ad on the New York Times website. Well, the New York Times used to get 100% of the revenues from the advertising of the website. Now it would only get 10%, if that, 20% of the outside, probably closer to 5%. There's just not money there. The networks get the money to the extent there is money in smart advertising. And this is the future of advertising. So we've lost what had been 50 to 100% of the revenues for all journalism is basically being erased as we go to a digital future. And to give some sense of how grim this is, the Guardian newspaper, coincidentally the paper that released the Snowden revelations with Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian newspaper is probably the most successful online newspaper in the world, based out of England, with the Guardian print paper providing the lion's share of the profits. It's owned by Family Trust, the Scott Family Trust, and they win all the awards. They have enormous web traffic. I mean, if there's anyone who's going to make a go of it online as a journalism entity, it would be The Guardian. And in the last year, in an interview, the head of it said, you know, once the print money dries up, the money we get from our newspaper advertising and sales dry up, we don't see a way we can possibly maintain our service at anything close to what we've been doing, because there's just not a future online that makes sense economically. So this is the great crisis I outline in the book in some detail. And I to get back to the beginning of your question, Bonnie, I think this is an existential problem for our society. And this isn't my opinion, actually. This is Jefferson's opinion and Madison's opinion. This is the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in every decision where it's considered the importance of the press. Our constitutional system, by all accounts of people who study it, is predicated on there being a vibrant press system that draws people into public life and monitors people in power. The Supreme Court has said it. If we don't have that, the whole constitutional system collapses. So when I emphasize this in the book, it's not a sort of pet peeve of mine. I think it's basically, it's impossible to imagine a free society without a vibrant journalism.
We're speaking with Robert McChesney. He's a scholar and media historian, professor of communication at the University of Illinois, and co-founder of Free Press. That's a national media reform organization. His latest book is Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Topical Currents, taking a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with media scholar and author Robert McChesney. He's the author of Digital Disconnect. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. And email is?
Email is radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Robert McChesney, I was struck by a quote in your book that says, "It's good dog food if the dog will eat it." Give us the meaning of that.
I don't remember writing that, to be honest. Was that my quote, or was I quoting someone?
You may have been quoting someone, but it was in the book, and it's kind of obvious that if it works, people are just satisfied with it.
You know, I can't remember writing that or what context that would have been in.
Okay.
So I'll have to pass on that.
Okay, I want to go back to the state of journalism. It's a pretty dismal situation. Do you see any solutions?
Yeah, I do. And I think that there's actually a wonderful historical precedent that Americans can follow to solve the problem. And it's our own history. I mean, one of the great features of American history that has largely been unknown, although some scholars, including myself, have done a lot to unearth it in the last 5 or 10 years, is that there's an extraordinary history of public investment in maintaining free and independent competitive journalism in the United States. Because if you recall what we were just talking about before, Bonnie, we said that between 50 and 100% of all the revenues for journalism for the last 100 years, depending on the medium, have come from advertising. The logical question is, well, then how did we have a news medium prior to advertising? Because advertising only emerges as a key force in our economy in the late 19th century, 1880s, 1890s. And really, it's not until the early 20th century when you have Madison Avenue and ad agencies and all that stuff come along. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what did we do from 1776 or 1787 until 1887? And what's stunning when you look at American history is that the framers understood this as a crucial political problem. Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, they wrote about it. They exchanged letters. And what they did is they instituted massive subsidies, federal government subsidies, to spawn an independent free press. And the most important of the subsidies was a postal subsidy. The post office basically charged barely nothing for a newspaper to be delivered. And almost all newspapers were delivered by the post office for the first 50 years of American history, and all weekly newspapers to the present day. But daily, in the first several generations of the country, it wasn't uncommon for the post office to make delivery 2 or 3 times a day in a major city like in New York or Philadelphia, and to deliver on Sunday. So newspapers were being delivered by the post office, and they were basically delivering for all but free. It was a huge public subsidy. In fact, in our research, we discovered my work with John Nichols, that if the United States today subsidized journalism to the same extent we did in the United States in the 1840s, where we had really good data, as a percentage of GDP, the federal government had to spend in the area of $35 billion. That's how extraordinarily large the subsidy was. And it gave the U.S. a diverse print media that was the envy of the world throughout the 19th century.
So what does it have to
do with? So I think that means we think in terms of, if the market can't produce it, and it can't, then we have to think in terms of what could be enlightened subsidies like the postal subsidy that could spawn an independent, competitive journalism that would cover our elections, cover our communities, cover people in power, draw people into public life, and pay them. And this gets back, Bonnie, to the question you had earlier, which is, you know, can we have journalism, as some people said on the internet, we can just have people be volunteers. We are all journalists now. We can take our smartphone and go to the meeting or the demonstration and hold it up and take pictures and explain what we see. Won't that be sufficient? And I think the evidence is in on that one. There's wonderful things that can be done by citizens with their smartphones at a demonstration or a meeting, but that isn't going to be sufficient to give us the journalism we need, which requires people who sometimes are experts in areas, people who are accountable for beats, people who will cover stories they're not interested in. We can't just have volunteer journalists who cover baseball games or the stuff they're interested in. And we need accountability. We need fact-checking. We need proofreading. We need a lot of stuff that goes to making great journalism, not the least of which are powerful institutions that can protect journalists and stand up to people in power, both government and private, because great journalism ultimately is going to antagonize someone in power, or else it's probably not great journalism. So we have to have subsidies that give us that. I mean, and I think in the book I provide one option, one idea, but I'm open-minded, and I think there's a lot of ways we can solve it. Now, it's worth noting that in other democratic nations, the traditional way to start, the first thing you would do to deal with this crisis, is you would have extensive public broadcasting. I was just recently in Scandinavia. My wife's Norwegian, and I was in Stockholm at the University of Stockholm at a conference of Scandinavian media scholars. And they have the same collapse of journalism, of their print media. They're suffering just like we are in the United States. And they see that there's an end of the road for commercial journalism coming in Scandinavia, just like there is in the United States. But the crisis doesn't seem so severe because they have extraordinary public broadcasting, which has, you know, newsrooms in local communities with several working journalists. And they also have subsidies to keep second, third, fourth newspapers alive in smaller towns that wouldn't be commercially viable otherwise. So they've used public subsidies to keep a credible, vibrant free press. It's worth noting on that point, and I talk about this in the book, those countries in the world that have the largest subsidy of journalism in democratic nations, Norway, Sweden, Germany, those countries invariably, by every global measure of democracy, those nations rank as the most democratic nations in the world by The Economist magazine, by Freedom House, by virtually every nonpartisan survey.
Why does the internet seem to spawn so much entertainment, news, and fluff?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I don't know if it really spawns, you know, I don't write about that specifically in the book, and I haven't done research specifically on that. We know why it doesn't spawn the other stuff, because it's harder to do, and it costs money, and it's not as fun to do. It's probably a lot easier to talk about a celebrity's rear end or what work they've had done or their career or some movie or music you like than it is to sit through what might be seen as a boring county board meeting that's going to determine whether a toxic dump gets built near a school. And so we need the latter. That's going to be less likely to get someone to sit through it. I would imagine if we're having a volunteer-driven system or a system where there's not resources to really pay journalism, it's going to gravitate towards that sort of stuff. That would be my best answer I could give.
You know, you were talking earlier about the tracking abilities of today's internet. About a month ago, I saw a car on the road, and I liked the looks of it, and I entered it in the computer and saw it. And even a month later, I'm still getting pop-ups all the time for the manufacturer of that car.
You know, and I think people are all starting to notice that. And this is ironic, because when I was writing this book, it was before I'd studied smart advertising and the surveillance, and I was just getting into it. So this is going back a year and a half or so. And I'm working on the book. And the smart advertising has just developed in the last year and a half. So it's really breaking as we talk now. And it's like a revolution in advertising based on surveillance. But as I was working on the book, I'm a basketball fan. And I was at one of the basketball sites I read when I'm trying to kill time between working. And there's an ad in the margin for my book, Digital Disconnect, which hasn't even been finished yet. And I'm thinking, boy, my publisher is unbelievable. They're running ads on basketball websites for my book. This is the greatest thing since I showed. I've never had such a great publisher. They must be everywhere on the internet. And then, not shortly after, I realized, no, they know that I have an interest in that book because they probably Googled it. And then they probably, I'm the only person who was getting that ad that the publisher was running. There were probably 10 people on earth getting it. But you're right. And, the line on the internet is that if you get something for free on the internet, you're not the customer. You're the product. You get it for free because Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, and Apple, of course, and Amazon don't always give you stuff for free, but they still collect data. They give you what you get for free because they get to collect data from you. You know, and in the book, I go into great detail about how this works and the problems with it in terms of privacy, the immense policy fights over privacy rights that are going on right now in Europe and in the United States. It is... it's a situation where, you know, it's impossible for a person basically to maintain their privacy and have a digital life. You know, one study said that if you actually read all those like 4-point type things you sign off on to do Google and Facebook, if a human read all the stuff they have to sign off on, the privacy agreements to do anything online, it would take a month and a half a year to read them all. You know, so it's clearly no one ever reads those things. You don't have time to. You just basically say, okay, I'm getting it for free, or I want this service. I'm going to just give it away, whatever they say, and play by the rules. And then one of the things you also sign away is your right to sue these companies. That's also in the fine print.
And you have to be sort of judicious about what sites you open up, because then you're going to open the door to being solicited even more.
And, you know, I don't want to be too dark on this, but I mean, I think once you get involved, it's more or less at this point a lost game. There's very little you can do. I mean, there are some things people do, like they could go to new servers. They scrub their computer. They spend a lot of time. People are really devoted to this. But realistically, for most people, for myself, I don't have time to like scrub down my computer and clean it and get a new work in a different identity. And I just don't have that much time in the day. And I'm not trying to hide anything especially. I mean, I just accept it as the price I have to pay to have access to these services. That lends itself to the question of privacy, because if we did have real privacy protection, then these companies wouldn't be able to do what they do and make the money they make, or they would have to charge for them. I mean, we have some serious questions to ask about these services if we're going to start talking about privacy, because then how do you have Gmail if they don't have the right to know everything you do online and sell that information as they see fit, which is currently the deal? What happens to social media? Facebook no longer has the right to do all that. What incentive do they have if they can't know everything about you? These are fundamental questions, and I think they're questions we have to have. They're political questions. And the reason they're political questions is that, and this is one of the great themes of the book, and it was the first question you asked, Bonnie, right out of the gate, which is one of the striking things about the Internet. Despite the great promise that it was going to be this agency of competition in the American economy, it is the greatest producer of monopoly ever in the history of capitalism, if not all economics. I mean, when you look at the Internet today, it is really the private preserve of just a very small number of astronomically huge companies that dominate it. 12 of the 30 largest companies in the United States today in terms of market value, 12 of the 30 largest publicly traded companies are Internet companies, and they're almost all monopolies. Google, Amazon, Apple, AT&T, Verizon, Qualcomm, Cisco, Intel, they almost all are what economists would call monopoly. And what I mean by that is it's not that they have 100% of the market, a monopoly, the only one who sells a product. Rather, the way economists have used the term monopoly means that a company has such a significant part of the market, usually well over 50%, that they can control the price completely, and they really can control the amount of competition by what the price they set will determine how many outliers there will remain in the market. Even John D. Rockefeller in his prime with Standard Oil did not have 100% of the oil market. I think he might have had in the 80s. But it was enough basically to give him complete control over oil in the United States. And Google, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, eBay, they're all in that boat. They all have that sort of market power. And this is one of the great features of the Internet, that because we don't pay for it directly, they just take our information, we don't notice as much, except for with Internet access and cell phone access where we pay through the teeth. But it's going to be an increasingly important issue that we have these digital monopolies that so dominate our political economy.
We're speaking with Robert McChesney. He's professor at University of Illinois and co-founder of Free Press. And his latest book is Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. If you want to join in the conversation, we have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email
radio@wlrn.org, or you can tweet us, that's @topicalcurrents. First up on the phone, this is Paula in Dania. Hi there.
Hi. It's fascinating, so well-spoken. Yeah, the decline of journalism, so true. For example, since he went away, all I hear is fugitive. I never hear the word whistleblower in the news. So much for the Fourth Estate. I think a lot of our troubles began with 9/11. If you're not with us, you're against us, and the WMD lies. It really quashed dissent and polarized the country. And the media was in collusion with the war on terror by not giving all the news in Iraq. For example, $12 billion a week off the books. So people like me had to really search details of all the superficial stories. There was a lot of info that you had to really, really search for. And even now, I live in Florida. One newspaper mentions Guantanamo. I'm nervous. And the other newspaper never mentions Guantanamo. The decline of journalism is really, really sad. It's all superficial and sensationalism. And I thank him for, what's the name of it? Digital Disconnect.
Yes.
Okay.
By the way, we'll have a link to that book on the Topical Currents Facebook page as well as the WLRN.org website.
And what is the link for the Free Press? What is that website?
Just freepress.net.
Okay. I want to get back to the privacy issue. What is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing Protection Act, and where does it stand?
Well, this is a law that has been kicked around now in the House and the Senate for the last couple of years on sort of outlining the nature of the relationship between private companies and the NSA and the CIA and police authorities and the military, trying to codify it. And there's interest in both sides to do that. I mean, it's all going on already. The Snowden revelations show that. So, and I've documented in the book as well. And this is more to codify it, to sort of give it some legitimacy sort of after the fact, and also to set the ground rules for how it will proceed going forward. And the wrangling that's been going on, it has not been passed finally. The wrangling that's been going on concerning CISPA has been primarily of a nature of whether the companies can do it voluntarily, how much they're going to be paid. It's wrangling just basically over the terms of the deal. I don't think there's no great challenge to the legitimacy of the idea in Congress that private companies should be working closely with our government, sharing all sorts of data about American citizens.
How about the what are some of the best non-commercial internet sites in your view?
Well, there's wonderful ones, and I hope your listeners are familiar with them. If they're listening to this program on the internet, which they may well be, that's probably one of them. I think there are Wikipedia is the classic example.
I've been burned by Wikipedia a few times.
You have been?
Yeah, with erroneous information.
Well, in my case, I've been burned because, you know, sometimes people go on to there's a page for me and they'll just put in some crazy stuff, you know, and it finally gets cleaned out. But it's, you know, I've had people write me and say, did you really do X, Y, and Z? I say, I don't know what you're talking about. They say, well, it's on your Wikipedia page. It must be true. So that's, you know, one of the perils you have with something like Wikipedia. But I must say, in general, I find Wikipedia fairly good source. I mean, I think it's really a testament, I think, to what people can do in a cooperative manner. And I wouldn't have thought it possible, frankly, before it existed at the level that it's done. But, you know, there's wonderful nonprofit, non-commercial sites. The problem is this, that there's just not a lot of money out there. And so what you find with the internet, and this isn't something I came up with. This is well recognized by anyone who writes about the internet, is they have what we call the long tail. The traffic on the internet is highly concentrated into, you know, a few dozen sites or a couple dozen companies that get the overwhelming majority of the traffic. And then there's this long tail of hundreds of millions of websites and services online that get very little traffic, but do exist. So if you're out there, you can find them and you can find a groovy place to do it. The problem is that these hundreds of millions of websites out in the long tail and web pages, you know, there's no incentive for them to be refreshed and kept up to date unless someone's going to pay the bill for them when they have very few visitors. And so they tend to atrophy. And so even though the internet is an infinite place and anything can be put up there and anyone can do anything, that's the theory, in reality, the market, as it works, rewards on the internet a very small number of players and makes it difficult, really, for others to survive. And that's the great crisis of the internet.
Yeah. Do you think a Google could start today? I mean, could we have anything like Google today starting?
Here's something really funny. When Google began, it did it in the late 1990s. Its first act was to make one of the gross violations of federal law ever. Because what Google did is it took a photograph, in effect, a copy of everything online, and violated all sorts of copyright law. Because it had to start by doing that so it would have something people could search for. And it did that once. And, you know, Google has said itself that if the copyright rules were enforced then, but if the new ones that are in place today existed then and were enforced, No, they could never have started Google. This is something that Sergey Brin has said in interviews. And I think even, you know, so yes, I think that the problem with new companies starting is that you've got more rules to jump over, you've got copyright issues to deal with, and you've got patent issues to deal with. And patents have been a huge problem because what these giant companies have found, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, is if you patent everything, then if someone tries to come along and start the next Facebook or some new thing that no one's thought of, and you've got a bunch of patents, even if your patents aren't really that great, and they wouldn't hold up. You force the entrepreneur to go into court for a couple of years to do battle with you and your team of brilliant, high-paid lawyers that all these companies have. And that scares a lot of entrepreneurs away. So I would say that it's much harder to be the next Google, to be the next Yahoo, Microsoft, eBay, whatever. And as in my book, I describe a market that is not completely solidified, but I think we are closer to the end than we are to the beginning in terms of a stable market where we have a handful of these giants, and I've named them already. They're enormous companies, each of which has a monopoly gusher core enterprise online, whether it's books and retail for Amazon or whether it's software for Microsoft, search for Google and advertising. And they use their monopoly profits from their core enterprise to branch out and to try to attack their fellow competitors and to get become, you know, they all do smartphones now. They're all working on some sort of e-reader. They all have, they try to complement each other, try to be full-service shops. And in this world, it is proving much, much more difficult for the little person to get away in. It is a classic, highly concentrated, highly monopolistic market, and it's the largest sector of the economy in terms of market value.
We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney. He's a scholar and media historian and teaches at communications at the University of Illinois. The name of his latest book is Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Let's take another break, and we'll be back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're with media scholar and author Robert McChesney of the University of Illinois. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. We have a couple of lines open. 1-800-743-WLRN and email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Next up, we have Danny. He's in Boca Raton. Hey there.
Hey there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a very quick question. I've set up my computer. I'm a computer professional, by the way. I've set up my computer in a way that I never, ever see any advertising on any website that I ever go to. And I diligently scrub my computer using, tools like CC Cleaner, AdBlock, all that stuff. My question is from an ethical perspective. In reality, I'm agreeing, Facebook, Google, and all these companies to give me information or give me their services, by the premise that I will look at their advertising and, have them make money off of me. But, I never participate in this. I never get any advertising from these people. So I'm asking a question based on ethical perspective of my actions. I'm agreeing to something. I'm using their systems. Yet I'm not taking, honoring my end of the deal, and not getting anything from them. And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you so much.
Well, that's a great question, and I really don't think you have an ethical obligation, unless in the contract that you signed. And I don't think it's in the contract. Someone would have to hire a lawyer to figure that out, probably. But I doubt in your contract you're signing, say, I promise that I will do nothing to impede your ability to spy on me and everything I do on the internet so you can sell me stuff. I doubt if that is in the contract, then you might have ethical concerns. But I really don't think they're advertising that fact. They're using more circumspect language to describe the activity. So I don't think you've got an ethical concern there. And I think you also touched on a very point that's got to be remembered in this monopoly question. One of the reasons people do have to sign away their privacy far more than people have ever had to give it up in our history, I mean everything, is that there isn't competition, really. These companies are just they own the board. If you want to do effective email online, there really are only a few players. If you want to do effective search, there are only a few players. You wanted to get a smartphone, there are only a few players. And with this monopolistic power, it gives them tremendous leverage to set the terms. As economists will tell you, if we had a more competitive market, with lots of players competing, there would be a much greater likelihood that people would be offering better terms to us, and probably someone would be offering a lot more privacy. But in a monopolistic market, it's just not going to happen. There's no leverage.
We have a tweet wanting to know if you've read the books The Highwaymen by Auerbach on the 1996 Telecommunications Act.
Oh, my God, that's a throwback. Yeah, I think I did, but it's been a while.
Okay, or Where Wizards Stay Up Late is his other one.
Sounds like a good book, but I don't can't recall it offhand.
Okay.
Robert McChesney, touch on where we are as far as net neutrality.
Well, net neutrality is this policy which basically means the internet service providers, the phone companies and the cable companies, cannot censor the internet. They can't. They have to treat all websites and all data services equally. They can't use their control over the monopoly pipes to sort of favor one service over another. They can't convert it basically into cable television so they can determine what goes through and what doesn't, and shake down people to pay them rents if they want to get through on their system. And we have net neutrality in the United States traditionally. That's what one of the great things about the internet is that phone and cable companies let everything come through. And they didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart. They did it because that was the policy, the common carriage policy originally that required them to do that. And the phone and cable giants and the cell phone companies now, AT&T and Verizon, hate the idea of net neutrality because they know as soon as they can say this website can't come through unless they pay us off and this other one can, they can make a ton of money. So it's been a huge fight to keep net neutrality as the rule of the land so all websites are created equal and everyone's got a shot and we won't have any commercial censorship or corporate censorship. And the reason why net neutrality is such an important rule, not to be Johnny One Note, is that we have a monopoly. You don't really have choices for broadband or smartphone. And if you only have a couple companies that agree on everything, it's impossible to get an alternative. So they basically had charged the same prices and offer the same services. And, you know, if they all agree they want to get rid of net neutrality, you won't have another option. So that's why it's so important to have this policy to make these monopolies respect net neutrality. Unfortunately, the Obama administration's FCC came up with a policy working closely with Verizon and Google and some other companies a couple of years ago. And it was really a Swiss cheese policy. It was a very strong policy for the wireline cable wire. So if you have a Comcast or cable company or phone wire into your home, you've got a neutral internet. All websites are treated equal. You don't have to worry about someone being censored or not on it. But at the same time, the same policy allows the smartphones to basically censor and pick what you can see and what you can't see. And as a result of that, you can't really – it's like being half pregnant. You can't really have a policy that only applies to some players and not others. It's only a matter of time, I think, till we lose it altogether because the players who are doing real net neutrality are going to say it's unfair that we have to meet a standard that these other companies don't. So it's a tenuous motion right now, and it's a very important fight.
So it would be like if someone who has basic cable and can't get to, say, HBO or Showtime – it would apply that way to the net, that maybe you could get to some sites, but not those who don't get paid.
Yeah, you'd have to pay more. You'd have to pay more at your end, and also HBO and Showtime would have to pay the ISP to get access to. They would get a cut, and they could favor their site. So let's say that AT&T or Comcast or Verizon, they had a favorite they had a better deal with Amazon than they did with Barnes & Noble, then only Amazon would be the privileged site on their system. The commercial benefits are endless. You can imagine the cash registers playing like a symphony in the minds of a CEO when you can start monkeying with that stuff. But it's a nightmare for a free society. It's a nightmare for a society where we're all online, that there's this bottleneck of a handful of companies that have the right to basically determine what you can and can't see and are not accountable to anyone but their shareholders.
Let's take a quick call, and then we'll go to the email.
Okay.
Andrew in Hallandale. Hi there.
Hey there. Firstly, another excellent show on politics, history, and culture. So I want to commend Bonnie and Joseph for this. My first question is, I believe everything discussed is only going to get worse. I'd like to know what the author thinks about that. And secondly, about public polling, I understand, you know, the media is so much about the Kardashians and a royal baby on the way and such. But what does polling show about what the public generally thinks about the Fourth Estate itself?
Well, boy, great questions. Is it only going to get worse? Yeah, I think that it will get worse, but I'm an optimist, and that's a show for probably another show. That's a longer discussion politically. but I'm an optimist because I think that the problems that this sort of monopoly power and this, creates, not just in the internet but in our society as a whole, this inequality – can't last forever. There will be blowback, and I think there will be very positive blowback. I'm very encouraged about our younger generation as someone who teaches young people for a living. But I do think the near term, yeah, it's going to get worse. And I'm trying to explain in the book why it looks the way it is, why we're going the way we are, and then provide a sense of what we can do to put it on what I would think a more democratic and a more humane path. As for public polling about the Fourth Estate, actually I refer to this a little bit in the book and more in some other writings. I think public confidence in journalism has plummeted in the last 30 years, yeah, for understandable reasons. I mean, I think that people don't have a lot of trust that news media are doing an effective job of drawing them into public life and monitoring people in power and people who want to be in power. It's a perfectly rational response, in my view, and it should concern us. Again, I don't want to be Johnny One Note on this issue, but, you know, this is really, if we don't have a credible news media that talks about issues, that investigates people, that does the hard research, that really draws people to public life and gives them the tools to be participants. They know what they're talking about. If we don't have those institutions, it's really hard to have any credible notion of self-government. And understand that when you lose democracy, you also are losing your freedoms. There's no society where you keep your freedoms and all the things we like about being an American, and also we've given up on actually having credible democracy. You've got to have democracy if you want to keep your liberties.
We have an emailer who kind of speaks to this point, saying that you offered as a possible solution to the decline of written media government subsidy. But Aaron says, I don't see our country as a good example of a free democracy. How do you suggest we trust the government not to control the media when it's paying for it, especially when it's already controlled?
What a great question. It's one I'd wrestle with all the time. And, you know, the government's complex is not a singular thing. It's a bunch of different things that it does. And what politics is in the United States and in democracies is battling for the heart and soul of the government and having it do some things, respond to popular pressure. And that's true in the United States, too. Now, here, I think it's gotten out of hand. We've lost control to a large extent. But we still battle for the good things. And I think the record's pretty clear that we can have a government subsidy of important functions without having government control dominance that make it worse than the problem that begins with. Public education, colleges and universities. I teach at the University of Illinois. I write some controversial things. Listeners might have heard some of them in the last hour. But I've never had the governor come in or state legislatures call committee meetings just like, get me fired, lock me up, investigate what I do. There's a genuine respect, and there's institutions set up in such a way the government can't really do that. We have to think that way around media. You know, a lot of people make the same point the caller made about how it's impossible to trust the government. Are the same people who are out demonstrating to keep the funding for public education. But if that holds for journalism, why not for education? If we can't trust us to bankroll independent journalism, how can we trust it to educate our children?
We've been speaking with Robert McChesney. He's professor at the University of Illinois and co-founder of freepress.org. And the name of his latest book is Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Professor McChesney, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information also at the Topical Currents Facebook page, including book and author links. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Thursday, Bonnie Berman examines Miami's Bethlehem Project. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining. To the calendar, on this day in 1890, 123 years ago, the birth of Arthur Stanley Jefferson in Ulverston, England. He adopted the name of Stan Laurel and was second banana in Laurel and Hardy. And on this day in 1891, 122 years ago, the Hormel Company was founded in Austin, Minnesota. In 1937, it introduces Spam, still the world's largest selling canned meat. The word is a contraction of spiced ham and nearly requires a poached egg. Bonnie's not a fan. One more while we remember no seatbelts in our 1963 Fairlane. On this day in 1903, 110 years ago, the incorporation of the Ford Motor Company in Detroit. Henry Ford was 40 years old, and the principal investors were the Dodge Brothers. We leave with the most famous line of Stan Laurel, who came to the U.S. as an understudy of Charlie Chaplin. He was involved in 190 films. Laurel to Hardy, "That's another fine mess you've got me into." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.